Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the Marie Keating Foundation Talks Cancer podcast. I'm Helen Forrestal, Director of Nursing Services. And in this episode, we have the privilege of talking to Áine Murphy, Deirdre Dygan from the Marie Keating Foundation's Positive Living Community. These ladies will take us through their unique experiences living with metastatic breast cancer and want the listeners to understand what it means to have an incurable cancer. They will also enlighten us on what they would like women and men to know that they did not know. They will talk us through diagnosis, treatments, risks, family history, communication, clinical trials, counselling, palliative care, nutrition and exercise, and the possibilities of going back to work, and so much more in this incredibly impactful conversation. We have a lot to cover, so it's time to let the patients take the lead once again. It's a real privilege to have you here today. You're members of our Positive Living Group, and that means living well and living your best life despite metastatic breast cancer. So it's my honour and my privilege to have you here today. And I love talking to you. You're so open and honest, and I think our listeners are going to really not necessarily enjoy what they hear, but they're going to learn a lot from you. And this really is by patients for patients. So it's actually the lived experience. First thing I'd like to do is ask you both to introduce yourself. Áine, would you like to introduce yourself first?
Yeah, no probs. So my name's Áine and I was 53 years old when I was diagnosed with early stage breast cancer. And so there was a treatment plan put in place for me, and which included surgery and radiotherapy. But just before the surgery was going to take place, a scan showed that I had bone mets as well. So it was concluded that I had incurable cancer, but it's also known as de novo metastatic breast cancer. So hearing that news, I was absolutely devastated, and I couldn't imagine living my life with incurable cancer. But here I am 5 years later, and I'm still doing very well, and I'm thriving, and my scans have been stable. So it's turned out okay.
Yeah, well, Áine, congratulations on your 5-year milestone. I'm sure it was a milestone.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was a day I didn't think I was going to get to, certainly not in a healthy state. I thought I was going to be quite an unwell person. So I think the fear for the future was in my mind when I was told that I had incurable cancer. But that fear was lifted last week when I hit my 5-year milestone. So hopefully I'll meet my next 5-year and the 5-year after that.
Of course. Living with and beyond cancer, isn't that
with
what
and
it's
beyond,
all about?
Absolutely, yeah. It is.
And what about you, Deirdre?
Hi, thank you, Helen, for inviting us here today. My name is Deirdre. I was diagnosed in 2019 with metastatic breast cancer. I had it in my neck, and I had it in my breast, and under my arm, in my lymph nodes. So I started on chemotherapy for 6 months, which was not the most pleasant time, but you know what? The team and the matter were amazing. And then I had a mastectomy, which was the most horrific thing to go through, but with the support and the help of this group, mainly because they gave me so many tips on how to get on with it and how to cope with it and counselling. So I'm here now. I'm on new treatment, and I am still doing really well. I'm stable. I call myself Stable Mabel. So I'm doing really well, and I'm in a good place. And that's because of it's all about positive living, and that's what has me here.
What we really want to get across today to our audience is what you would like them to know that you didn't know, you know, when you were going through your journey. I think it's really important to learn from you about the lived experience. We did talk about the diagnosis. Áine, you said you were diagnosed with de novo cancer, and we actually, Niamh mentioned this in her first episode. Shocking experience, really, not even considering that there was too much wrong with you at the time. And there's a big question about how much information really that you should have at that time. And for you as well, Deirdre, like how much information can you actually take on board at that moment in time?
I think that moment when you're told, your survival mode probably kicks in. And I know in my head, everything just went quiet. Anything that was been said to me just went quiet. And really in my head, I was thinking, how am I going to get through this one? Because I would be a positive type of person. Mm-hmm. And I just felt I can't get any positive vibe in my being to kind of give me the strength to get through this. But I know they had said to me in the hospital, you know, this is very treatable and people do live for a long time. But a long time to me, when I looked up stats, it was 2 to 5 years. And I thought, that's not a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to live longer than that. So I think at the initial meeting, you're not really taking in an awful lot of information, and your partner, whoever's there with you, they can listen in as well. And you can probably talk to each other when you're back out in the car. Mm. What did they say? Write that down. What do they mean by this? There was lots of forms, lots of pieces of paper, lots of prescriptions given to you. And, you know, that was all new as well. So I think really it would be very useful looking back if we could have gone back maybe 6 weeks later so that we could just get things cleared out in our head and just understand things a bit better.
Yeah. And for you, Deirdre, would you have like written down anything? Would you have brought a notebook or anything like that?
Absolutely nothing. To be honest with you, I just went like on you. I went blank. Mm-hmm. Now I had my sister and my husband with me, and I can honestly tell you it was just, I had no idea what was going on. Mm-hmm. It was just, I suppose, you go in, you know you're going to get some kind of diagnosis, but when you're told that it's incurable, suddenly you're, I don't know about anyone else, but I started planning my funeral in 2 seconds. Like, it was just unbelievable to think that this is, how long have I got? Yeah. And I didn't want to know the prognosis of how long I got, but I knew, but she kind of said, oh, you know, people live till they're, you know, 10 years, whatever, with this. Now, I was grade 3 at that stage. I was stage 3 at that stage. But after my operation, I went to stage 4. Mm-hmm. But in saying that now, there was, you know, like Anya, I would have loved to have gone back even with 2 or 3 weeks. I was given a nurse, but, you know, nurses are great. Don't get me wrong. They're fantastic. Mm-hmm. But to sit down with the oncologist and say, do you know what? Can you just explain this to me again?
Or,
you know, there's certain questions that it wasn't taken in. They, like my sister and my husband, took them in, but I'm the one that's dealing with it, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's would be a strong thing to do.
Yeah. So I think we can safely say that it's a life changing event. Mm. It's shocking, and that you don't take in. And research actually in the evidence shows that you only take in about 30% of what's said to you at that point in time. So a big lesson there, isn't there, to actually, you know, maybe bring a notebook. Certainly bring somebody with you and ask for a follow-up appointment soon after so that you can actually go away, take on board what they've said to you, absorb it to some degree if you can, but come back with all your questions.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And in that, Deirdre, you mentioned prognosis. Mm. Now, I think, again, and Anya, you said that you looked up Dr. Google.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a good idea?
No, never a good idea.
Never a good idea.
It's sometimes easier though, because you might be, like I found, and I'd say there's a lot of people like me, absolutely petrified of asking the questions, because if you ask the question, you have to be prepared for that answer.
Absolutely.
And sometimes Dr. Google gave that answer, but was petrifying also, because was it real or was it not?
And without explanation.
Without explanation, yeah.
Yeah.
But I also think with Dr. Google was, I would actually read that and then I go on to something more positive. I'd say, no, that's not right. I'd go on to something more positive.
Yeah. So no Dr. Google.
No, absolutely
okay.
not.
Okay. And then Niamh and Carl, in our first episode, were talking about the multidisciplinary team. Okay. And what I realized when I was talking to you ladies as a group, that not everybody knew about the multidisciplinary team. And I'm thinking, why don't you know?
Yeah, I don't know why we don't know, but it would have been very useful to know that your case is discussed in a room full of the experts. That not just one person is coming to the decision about your treatment, and to know that the surgeons, the radiographers, the radiologist, your medical oncologist, they're all going to be there, whatever nurse is going to be looking after you. And they're all agreeing on what treatment is best for you and what's best for you going forward.
Mm. How did that make you feel, Anya, to know that?
It certainly gives you peace of mind, you know, that you're not just relying on one person's point of view. And yeah, it just gives you a lot of peace, really.
And Deirdre, you mentioned there you were a stage three and then you went to a stage four. Would it have been in your mind to actually go for a second opinion?
No, the problem was that it was the treatment I was on didn't do as much as they thought. So okay. It was only 30%. Now, this doesn't happen. I was a rare case. Mm-hmm. But the treatment I'm on now is the right one for me. But and I don't want to frighten people, but I was just a rare case. And like, as far as they were concerned, they were hoping that the new treatment I'd be on would do it, and it has. But I'm not here to frighten anyone about it, but it meant I had further surgery, yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's really reassuring, you know, and wouldn't it be good for people to be told that there's a multidisciplinary team approach here, that there's a group of experts making decisions, and they come back to you telling you that what your treatment plan is, but it's an optimal treatment plan. That's
absolutely
really important, isn't it?
Yeah. I think the oncology team, they're doing this every day. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not the first person they've dealt with, but this is certainly your very first time to be diagnosed with an illness, and especially with cancer. So I think just a little guide through, just to let you know how things work, would be helpful.
Yeah. So again, maybe for our listeners to actually ask that question, like, am I being discussed at an MDT? You probably will find that most all women and men who are diagnosed with any kind of cancer will be discussed at an MDT, a multidisciplinary team meeting. But so important to know that. It gives such reassurance. Mm. And I know that from talking to many of you ladies and men in other groups, that this is the comfort that you need at that point in time, I think, rather than thinking, oh gosh, is this right?
Absolutely.
Do I believe this, or do I need to go and have a second opinion? So it kind of gives you that comfort and reassurance almost already. And the other point to make about MDTs is that when you have a biopsy or a tissue sampling, you're discussed at MDT, but you're also discussed when you have all your staging tests, like the CT scans, bone scans, PET scans that we mentioned right at the beginning. So it's really important that it's verbalized and it's understood.
Yeah.
Now, we've had discussions around treatments, I acknowledge that, like, I suppose clinics are very busy. But an important message that I think I've picked up from conversations with you is treatment, but benefits versus risks. Are you told about them?
No, well, certainly in my case, it was this is the treatment you're going to go on, and these are a few side effects, but nothing really. And it's kind of juggles in your head how much do you need to know at the very beginning, because, you know, you're frightened anyway. And I felt I don't need to ask any questions, because if there's any side effects, I'll know, because I had been so well. But certainly it is useful to know about the side effects, because there may be something that you worry about night after night. And it's unwarranted worry, really, if you just put your hand up and say, look, there's something happening here. And would this be down to my treatment?
Mm. Yeah, that's really important, isn't it? Mm. What about you, Deirdre? Did you get a full explanation and education around the treatments you were having?
I did, but I still ask loads of questions. If I found a side effect that I thought, like Anya was saying, like, oh God, where is this coming from or whatever, I would go. The minute I'd ask them, I'd ring the nurse or I'd be in for treatment. And I took everything that they told me to take. I took all the anti-sickness tablets, even if I didn't need them. And that's one thing I always advise people to do. When you're having chemotherapy, you don't know from day to day whether you're going to be sick or not. So to take everything and listen to these, the nurses are fantastic. Listen to them, what they say. But like that, I didn't. One or two things happened to me, like a rash, and or, you know, I said, oh my God, what's that happening? You know, you get a fright. You do get a fright. But, you know, just ask. And, you know, and they're there to listen to you and to give you advice.
So, again, it's a very important question. Maybe if it may have been answered, but if it hasn't been answered, to know that you're going away from your first or second clinic appointment, knowing what the benefits are of the treatment you're having, but also knowing about the risks associated and being able to manage them. And actually then maybe talking to your family and, you know, or whoever is supporting you so that they're aware of those risks and benefits
true,
as well.
Makes a big difference.
We always like to hear about the benefits, don't we? But not necessarily the risk. But we're upfront and honest here, and we're talking at it as it happens. So another interesting point that I'd like to raise here is, and particularly in this group, with yourselves with metastatic breast cancer, we know that over time there's often what we call manipulation of therapies, because one therapy, you mentioned that one therapy might not work for you. When is the right time for you to be asking a question? Okay, first line therapy is what you're on at the beginning. And if there is a manipulation or that treatment isn't working very well for the cell type that you have and the cancer continues to grow, you will probably go on a second line treatment. When is a good time to know about that?
I found when they told me, Kathy, my oncologist, just put me on it immediately. And I said, OK, can I speak to someone about this? Because I'd lost my hair, I'd lost my eyelashes, my eyebrows. And everything was slightly growing back a tiny bit. And let's face it, it's not an easy thing to lose. But and I thought, oh, God, I can't go through this again. So I spoke to the nurse and they gave me all this bump about it, and then I asked to see Kathy, and she rang me, and I went through it again with her. But you know, it's frightening going from one treatment and then go to another treatment because you don't know what the side effects are, whatever. But I just asked at the beginning, and I just felt I needed to know after coming off one. I just needed to know exactly how it's going to be, you know.
And did that feel reassuring?
It was. I have to say, it was very reassuring because. And I'm not being vain, but my hair, I wasn't going to lose my hair again.
Look, I think you've brought up a very important topic, really. And it's something that a lot of women go through, and men. And it can be really difficult, can't it?
I think it was the most horrific thing of it. But in saying that, I, you know, took it on board and I took it upon myself to get my hair cut short, then I went about the week with friends and made a day of it. We went for lunch and came out with the wig on my head and looked slightly different, but still had the same colour. And then I eventually got my head shaved, but only until I was ready.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I did step by step.
Yeah.
I held on to my eyebrows and eyelashes until the July, and I was so happy until one morning I woke up and I thought, I look different. But I went through my treatment in the pandemic. You know, some people say it's the best time to get breast cancer because you weren't out and about and nobody else was out and about. So you didn't feel as if you had to show yourself and people were going like, oh, God, love you, you know, that's awful, whatever, which people are very good and all that. But, you know, I think I was lucky in that sense.
You were hidden away.
Yeah.
It had its advantages, didn't it?
To an extent.
But also, I suppose, in COVID, it was a very lonely time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And kind of isolating for many of you, because you're already, as some of you would have said to me, it's a double whammy here, because you're already isolating anyway because you're on ongoing treatments. And here you are again. Now the world knows how you feel. And it's a true lesson, isn't it?
It was isolating, but somehow it kind of was a freedom as well, because we knew we had to stay put because the pandemic was very risky to our health. But the fact that everybody else was having to stay put made us feel very safe.
Yeah.
But things did change, like the appointments in the hospitals changed and your scan times have probably been cancelled. And there were things like that happening that were adding another level of fear for us, because things weren't happening according to your time schedule. Mm. You know, if you were for scans every 3 months or every 4 months or every 6 months, they were being changed, or outpatient clinics that you might have attended where you were been told not to come in for them. So, yeah, there was an awful lot of change happened during COVID as well. Yeah.
And I guess all your appointments went online.
Yours
did, Anya?
Mine went online. Okay. They're still online, really.
Yeah.
How does that feel if it can, you know, if you've, there's initially, nobody eyeballing you, as they say?
Yeah, funny. Initially, I was petrified about it because I thought, oh my God, they're going to miss something here, or, you know, this isn't fair. I should be brought in. I should be seeing the nurse, or, you know, how are they going to know if there's anything wrong with me? How am I going to get to say anything if I feel there's anything wrong with me? Things can be a little harder over the phone. Sometimes if your nurse gets to know you, they know just from the look of you that there's a problem. But then I kind of took strength from it, the fact that, well, they feel they don't need to see me. Mm-hmm. So I began to turn it the other way and thought, no, well, this is a good sign, actually, that I'm not going in for these appointments. That means I can skip off out of here and have less of a burden. And my diary was clearer as well. I had more free days all of a sudden.
A little bit of reverse psychology going on there, Anya, for you.
I think it happens all the time, this world.
Good strategy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Deirdre, you were seen in person, were you?
I was, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And she just continued on, and everyone was just, like, it was very small. But yeah, she did. Maybe one or two was a phone call, but mostly, yeah, went into.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. So the other thing I'd really like to, I suppose, maybe just draw some attention to, and I don't necessarily want to frighten anybody here, but probably knowing your own oncological risks, you know. So with metastatic breast cancer, we're talking about cancer, you know, breast cancer that can spread to the lung, or lungs, to bone, anywhere in the body. And there are some rarer sites where, you know, breast cancer can spread to. But for the main, maybe looking at, you know, the risks associated with having metastatic breast cancer, but it's in your spine. Have you been aware or told of any kind of maybe signs and symptoms that you would look out for if there was anything going on in that space?
Yeah, I haven't personally been told. Now, I do have cancer in my spine and hips. And I did ask, can I continue doing yoga or Pilates? That was as brave as I felt I could ask. But recently, my sister was talking about going on a skiing holiday, or, you know, my cousin has horses. To get up on the horse. But I thought, well, I haven't been told I can't. So I was thinking, I'll just go ahead and do it. But then you, kind of your sense kicks in and you're going, well, if I fell off the horse and I do have spine meths, maybe that's not such a good idea. But I think it would be useful to be told what your chances of spinal cord compression would be, because there could be things I could be doing that I'm not. I'm keeping myself safe by not taking the risks.
Yeah. And maybe knowing the signs and symptoms of that risk as well, and particularly for spinal cord compression, depending on where it is in the spine. If it's in the thoracic spine, you know, you can have problems with going to the toilet, both urinary and bowel wise, so it becomes sluggish. Or you can even get feelings of maybe what we sometimes call spongy feet, where your feet feel like they're walking on, you know, sponge or pins and needles. They're a sign. And it's an early indicator. So it's always good to know these things, I think.
Yeah, and I think when I do go back to my consultant, I will be certainly asking that question. But I think a lot of these things that I learned, the questions I learned to ask, we learn through the Positive Living Group.
Mm.
And it's just from listening to the other girls that what they're going through, our gents, what they're going through and learning, well, you know what, that is a question I need to know.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know a couple of ladies in the group who have been, you know, have close kind of experience to that. So it's learning for us all, isn't it? It's learning for everybody. So I suppose it's just knowing, like, I think most people on chemotherapy will certainly know about neutropenia, where the neutrophils drop and, you know it's an oncological emergency, your temperature goes up, you feel very unwell, and you have rigors or shivering, and you need to be in a hospital. Mm. And anybody who has chemo is kind of educated around that. Mm. Pain can be a bit of an issue as well, can't it? And it's like managing that pain. So if you get pain, you know, think about it early, talk about it, and manage that as early as you possibly can, so that it doesn't become complex. But pain is complex, because pain can be like psychological, but it can, and it's also very physical. But talk it out, I think, is really important, isn't
it? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Have you had any talk on oncological emergencies for yourself, Deirdre?
No, well, I ended up in an emergency myself. I ended up in the October with pneumonia. And then whether the chemotherapy had excavated my heart, where I had an irregular heartbeat, I had a cardioversion. I've never been so well since with my heart, by the way. Okay. It jump-started me back.
And I suppose one other thing I'd like to mention are the cognitive changes. You know, breast cancer can spread to brain as well. We have a member in our group, as you know, with brain mets. And recognizing that as well as maybe, you know, possible. Well, I'm sure your oncologist will tell you if it's a possibility, but that, you know, that feeling of memory loss, more so than just the, you know, the chemo memory loss that we talk about, but memory loss and mood change, and even sight, you know, changes in your sight and vision.
Yeah.
So really important, and really not trying to frighten anybody here, but just talking these things through is really, really important. And that's what we're here for, is to, you know, for people to know what you didn't know. Okay, so I think the other point that we have discussed before, and it comes up again and again, is clinical trials. You know, we've talked about first stage and second stage and maybe even third stage treatments. But clinical trials are often something that's thought about, maybe not discussed so much. Is this something that's in your own paradigm at the moment? Have you discussed it, or have you a willingness to know, or do you want to know?
Yeah, no, definitely would be very interested in a clinical trial. And I said it from day one, if ever there was anything out there, I'd certainly be availing of it. But I'm still on my first line treatment and everything's going very well. So for me, the clinical trials aren't needed or required just yet, but certainly I'll be checking again to make sure that it is on my chart that I'm interested in the clinical trials.
Okay, and that's a good message, isn't it? Like, if you are interested in a clinical trial, it's maybe saying it out loud, isn't it, when you're at your appointments, not necessarily on the first occasion, because some, I know there's a couple of ladies in the Positive Living group who have strongly considered clinical trials, and then they've kind of chased after it a little bit and educated themselves and done quite a bit of research and probably acknowledged that there are no clinical trials for them at the moment, but they've actually had those discussions with their oncologists, so that the oncologist is aware as well. And, you know, who knows, clinical trials in phase three, when they're ready, can be beneficial to some people, but not to all. And it's just, it's very personalised type of medicine, isn't it?
Yeah.
What about you, Deirdre? Would you be?
Yeah, this actually, they do the clinical trials while I'm having treatment in the oncology ward. And there's one of the girls who, one of the nurses that's involved. I had a talk with her because I would have known her from when I started. And she's now moved on to clinical trials. And it was really interesting. So I watched a webinar on it as well. But I said to her, like, when? And she said, look, there's so many things coming on board. If you need it, you know, it will be suggested to you. But it's amazing what they're doing. It really is. Oh, my God. Fantastic.
Why we're all here today. But it's something, I suppose, to remind ourselves as well, clinical trials are often very much around the subtypes of breast cancer that you might have. The subtype is very important for some people.
I think especially if you're got a family history of it, you know, whereas I came into it with no family history, I think your head would probably be more full of questions with if there was a family history there, then the subtype is more important to you. But I believe along the way, the subtype can change, you know.
Can change for some
people.
You
can't plan too much into the future with it either.
Yeah. Yeah, and I suppose, like, if you're the type of person who wants to know a little bit more about your subtype, it's a question that you ask, isn't it? And
yeah.
It could be HER2 positive. We talked about the subtypes on episode one. If our listeners would like to tune back to episode one, they'll learn more about the subtypes there. So, yeah, it's an interesting conversation.
I think the subtypes also have a lot to play in the type of treatment you're going to be on as well.
Yeah.
And often you'll come into a group and you've got 10 people all with metastatic breast cancer, but we're all on different types of treatments. And, you know, when you're only newly diagnosed, your big question is why? Why am I on the same treatment as the person sitting next to me?
Yeah.
And along the way, you do begin to learn that there are different subtypes and therefore there are different treatments.
Yeah, and you're all learning that. But it's also, I suppose, it can be dangerous to know too much. You know, we've seen that in the group as well.
Yeah.
Sometimes, like, people are concerned that they're not on a treatment that you might be on because you're doing really well on that treatment.
Mm.
But there's reasons, isn't there, for that? And it's just kind of pulling back. And again, I can't emphasize it enough. Cancer, even breast cancer, different types of cancer, it's a very personalized medicine.
Yeah. I think there has to be a balance in your where you're going to go with checking out the type of cancer you've got, because at the end of the day you have to have a quality of life as well. And that's really the medics are in there treating you so that you do have a quality of life. So, you know, it's important to live that life as well.
Absolutely.
Get out and enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
And I'm just coming back to, we're just looking at when you're in a clinic and you've been given a diagnosis, some of you are saying that it's really nice to take something away with you. And that might be a book or a reference to a cancer support centre or service somewhere.
Yeah, certainly if you're in the hospital and you've been told, you probably do look around for things that might link. It may not be your first visit now. It may be maybe a week, 2-3 weeks when you're sitting there and you're still getting used to this new world you're living in. You begin to look around the waiting area, and it's a great place to have information, actually, because you're usually sitting there twiddling your thumbs waiting for your name to be called. So it's great to have a leaflet, and even if there is a book there, to pick it up. And then that leads you to your support networks, and the support networks are really, really so important to your mental health, because that's what gets you through, really.
Mm. But even like booklets and knowing... knowing your key person, like if it's a clinical nurse specialist, if it's an advanced nurse practitioner, having their name and maybe having a direct line to them so that you can, call them if need be.
In fact, I think COVID helped with those little booklets because I had never been given a booklet until about 6 months ago. And on that booklet was the emergency call lines, your nurse line, who to call after hours, things like that. So that's very, very beneficial to a patient. And it doesn't mean you're ever going to use it, but the fact that you have it there just gives you peace of mind and takes away some of the anxiety that you may worry with. Because
I'm saying that now. And when I was diagnosed about 2 weeks later, I was called in for ARC.
Mm-hmm.
And ARC bring you around and explain. They sit you down all about chemotherapy. I don't know. Did you have this?
No, I didn't have that.
Because you were having chemotherapy. But it sat you down, explained what happens to you. And it was so beneficial.
Yeah.
It really was. Mm. Now, there wasn't as huge amount of information when I looked at it now. But still, it was there for us and brought us up to the treatment ward. And as she said, nobody looks sick here, do they?
You know,
and it's true. You know, I think, and I know I'm probably holding up, but I always on television, they portray chemo wards as people going, you know, like they're dying. They're just, people are getting on with their lives. They're getting treatment,
of course.
You know.
Yeah.
And they're getting on with it.
Yeah.
But and I'd recommend ARC for the beginning.
I would add to that, Deirdre, because, again, you know, there are cancer support centres all over Ireland.
Mm.
So you can tap into a cancer support centre wherever you are, really.
Absolutely.
I mean, it needs to be convenient, I suppose, as well. You need to be able to get to it. But they have so many services on offer, and it might be just that cup of tea you need, or like a a supportive space or just, you know, an open space to go to.
It makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Counselling.
It's good to be directed, isn't it? It's good to be, you know, to know that there are cancer support centres all over the country. You have the Marie Keating Foundation. We also have the Irish Cancer Society. But you also have, let's say, all those cancer support centres. And we have websites, don't we? And I think it's really important, you know, to be directed to trusted websites.
Absolutely, yeah.
And not Dr. Google. I know it's really difficult, isn't it? Because most of us will go to Dr. Google, but you won't have somebody sitting beside you to kind of, you know, explain the information that's been provided. And you can read whatever you want into that. And,
absolutely,
you know, the glass could be half full or half empty at any point in time. So I would advise and I suppose signpost people to the HSE website, to the Marie Keating Foundation website, to CR UK, the Irish Cancer Society. And Macmillan is a really good website as well.
Excellent,
And just look at the resources that are available. Anya and Deirdre, it's been a pleasure having you today. I'm sure our listeners will get so much from our conversation, and there's nothing like the lived experience. So you've both, I suppose, demonstrated that really well, and fair play to you. We're not finished yet. We're going to be joined by Lisa in our next episode, and we're going to talk all about living with and beyond cancer. So thank you.
Thanks, Helen.
Thanks, Helen.
That's all for this episode. Thank you again to our wonderful guests for their inspirational insights and learnings. To our sponsors, Novartis and Roche, for their support in making this series possible. And to you for tuning in. Join us next time where we will once again be talking all about breast cancer. And in the meantime, you can visit mariekeating.ie for more information on breast cancer awareness and support.